So it's the 60s, and the big story in music is rock and roll. In 1964, Beatlemania hits the US, and I Want to Hold Your Hand reaches number one. Within 8 weeks, the Beatles have five of the top spots. Worldwide record sales go to $1.2 million a month. So the U.S. music market quickly returns with a whole host of rock bands, groups now, instead of just a star singer. Plus, there's the baby boom. You've got 40% of the population under 20 in 1964. And this brings unprecedented purchasing power to a younger market. So every jazz musician is going to be asked by, if they're on a label, by a record executive, so how do we tap into this? In the old days, when it used to be that jazz was a catalog seller, so you might sell slowly, but eventually, okay, you might have 10,000 or 20,000 or maybe even 50,000 units. But after the rock explosion, record companies expect 100,000 albums to be sold, and they want it right away. But fusion is a tricky word to associate with jazz. Jazz has always been a music of fusion, especially in New Orleans, when jazz was an amalgam of blues, rag, and the march, and later popular song. Last week we added Cuban and Brazilian music. Next week we'll add the music of Northern Europe. And after that we'll get further afield to South Africa, to India. So jazz is a real mutt, and it always has been. So, what is this specific genre, then, that we call jazz fusion? What is being fused? What things are going to fuse? And what's it going to sound like? So how about this? Is this fusion jazz? This is probably the first thing you thought of. This gets a lot of play these days. It has lots of other names. It's sometimes known as smooth jazz, light jazz, or the quiet storm. It's actually the quiet storm. It's sometimes called yuppie jazz or hot tub jazz. I can't say the other names for it because they're not polite. But if that's the sound of fusion jazz, then what's this? Nothing very smooth about that. So this is Chick Corea and his group Return to Forever, with Stanley Clarke and Bill Connors on guitar and Lenny White on drums. But how can this even be the same genre? So if you're going to make up a genre name for what you just heard, what would it be? Heavy metal jazz? Acid jazz? It certainly wouldn't be smooth jazz. But the other question you have to ask, again, is what is fusing with jazz? Well, the easy answer, given it's the 60s, is rock. But is it really rock? And is rock the only thing that's going on in the 60s? Is it really jazz rock fusion? What about jazz soul? As with all things, we return to Miles Davis. So think about what Miles Davis must have felt like in the mid-1960s. Since 1945, Miles Davis had been at the beginning of virtually every new movement in jazz. He'd had some of the greatest bands of all times. So now what? In the late 50s, Miles had been the avant-garde. He'd created the new thing, modal jazz. But now, Ornette Coleman and Cecil Taylor were the new thing. They'd taken the music further out, and Miles could not stand that music. Even worse, he was kind of satisfied with his current quintet, K. Can you remember who's in the Miles Davis mid-60s quintet? Wayne Shorter, ring a bell with Herbie Hancock? But despite all of the critical success, all the critics love this band. We love this band. Miles loved this band. But they weren't really selling a lot of albums. At the same time, and Miles Davis, remember, this is the Ferrari driving Miles Davis. So he sees rock coming along and swallowing jazz whole. Everyone's out of work. Jazz clubs are closing. Pretty soon, Miles Davis is no longer the headliner. He's the opening act for the Jefferson Airplane or the Grateful Dead. Here's what Miles had to say about all this. Quote, music was changing a lot in 1964. A lot of people started saying that jazz was dead, blaming the Way Out Free thing people like Archie Shepp and Cecil Taylor were playing. In fact, it didn't have no melodic line. It wasn't lyrical. You couldn't hum it. Now, I'm not saying these musicians weren't serious about what they were doing. People started to turn off to them. Coltrane was still going strong, so was Monk. People still liked them a lot. The Way Out thing, even Train went there before he died. Wasn't a lot of what people wanted to hear. But just a few years back, music we were playing was cutting edge. It's getting real popular, finding a wide audience. All that started to stop when the critics, white critics, started supporting the free thing, pushing them over what everybody else was doing. Jazz started to lose its broad appeal about this time. In place of jazz, a lot of people listened to rock music, the Beatles, Presley, Little Richard, Chuck Berry. And the Motown sound was the new rage. Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson, the Supremes. James Brown was starting to get hot, too. I think some of the pushing of the free thing among the white critics was intentional. A lot of them thought people like me were just getting too popular. Too popular in the music industry. They had to find a way to clip my wings. All of a sudden, rock and roll was in the forefront. White rock and roll, stolen from black rhythm and blues and people like Little Richard and Chuck Berry. All of a sudden, white pop music was being pushed on television and everywhere else. Before this, so-called white American pop music wasn't into anything. Now they were stealing, they sounded half-assed new. It had a little dip in it, a little bounce, a little half-assed hipness. But it still was square. It wasn't happening yet. Because what people now thought jazz was, non-melodic, not hummable. A lot of serious musicians had a hard time from then on. A lot of jazz clubs were closing down. So Miles Davis didn't want to get left out or left behind. So he started listening to music that was going on around him. James Brown, Jimi Hendrix, and especially Sly Stone. This is one of the songs that Miles Davis said was deeply influential on his thinking in the 60s. But then he met Jimi Hendrix. And he went to jam with Jimi Hendrix and said that Jimi liked what I'd done on Kinda Blue and some other stuff and wanted to add more jazz elements to what he was doing. He liked the way Coltrane played with all those sheets of sound, and he played the guitar in a similar way. He was a nice guy, quiet, but intense, and nothing like people thought he was. But Jimi Hendrix came from the blues, like me. We understood each other right away because of that. He was a great blues guitarist. Both him and Sly were great natural musicians. They played what they heard. There he is, Jimi Hendrix playing the blues. This is Voodoo Child from Electric Ladyland, which hit the U.S. in 1968, shot to number one in a month. It's your basic rock blues jam. Lord, I swear the moon turned a fire red. So Miles starts to imitate this music, and his jams in the studio become a little looser. He starts to thinking about how can he make more money and make it faster and bring his ideas to more people. So the next couple of albums have electric piano, and rather than having Wayne Shorter's smooth melodic, smooth melodies, he now starts to get a little less jazzy, more of a pop beat, themes with little riffs. He's trying to place down the jazz elements in his music. He has Herbie Hancock switch to electric piano, and then adds Chick Corea playing electric piano, so he's got two on electric piano. And then eventually a third keyboard, Joe Zawinul, who's Austrian, joins the band. Eventually Keith Jarrett replaces Herbie Hancock, and he brings in John McLaughlin, a British guitarist, and Benny Maupin to play bass clarinet. The next album, In a Silent Way, featured four pieces spliced together over a danceable beat. And while the album alarmed critics, it generated sales in a younger audience. It wasn't a huge commercial success, though. But the next album, from August in 1969, Bitches Brew, became one of the top-selling jazz LPs of all time. On this album, Larry Young replaces Herbie Hancock on electric piano. So the first thing to notice is the texture, right? I mean, it's rock, but it's not like a pop song, right? It's more like a loose, free jam, like the Jimi Hendrix piece we heard. You hear the multiple pianos. Not really a hard groove, nothing you'd call a disco beat or anything. So it's a rock beat, but it's kind of subtle, and it's jamming. And then Miles starts to play. So there's some different things you should notice about this music. The first is that while it does have a more recognizably rock groove to it, this is not pop music. These aren't really pop rhythms. It's really still pretty avant-garde stuff. It's not easy listening. So he's making a move toward more of a rock groove, trying to get an audience, but it's hardly condescending to an unsophisticated pop audience. It is more metric than free jazz, but it's still pretty dissonant and open-ended. This kind of free jazz, free jam session's a long way from a carefully engineered pop tune. Second, notice that Miles' own style seems to have changed again. He plays these single little notes, little bursts, darting runs. He uses single notes that bend and pierce. He also starts to use effects, a wah-wah pedal or an echoplex on the trumpet. It's not the patient construction of his early years, the easy melodies. It's a much more darting and spicy kind of playing. Another thing that changes around this time is the performance format. In the 1950s, Miles would stalk off stage after a solo. Now, clearly in charge, dressed wildly with the latest sunglasses, Miles would stalk around and call out rhythms and signal soloists. He started to play the organ so he could better direct and control the proceedings. Notice also he rarely lets his multiple keyboard players solo. Here's Miles in his own words, quote, "So I would direct, like a conductor. Once we started to play, I'd either write down some music for somebody, or I'd tell them to play different things I was hearing as the music was growing, coming together. It was loose and tight at the same time. It was casual, but alert. Everybody was alert to different possibilities that were coming up in the music. While the music was developing, I'd hear something I thought that could be extended or cut back, and I'd move over and make it happen." Something else that's new in the 70s and 80s is the bass line. 60s tunes often have a nice chord progression, but the most important new sound was the electric bass, and the guy who could play it was Larry Graham, whose slappin' and poppin' became part of the signature sound of Sly and the Family Stone. Notice how the bass line here is the tune. It's the signature part of the tune. Bink, dunk, dink. Bink, bonk, bink. All you have to hear is the bass line to know what piece it is. Compare this now to what Miles Davis starts doing. This is What I Say from the Cellar Door Session. To hear how this is another one chord bass line jam session, very much like Sly Stone's Thank You. Just set up a bass line and then everybody plays on top of it. So in a lot of ways, this sounds a little bit more like the Sly Stone or like what might be called soul jazz than maybe rock jazz, but we'll talk more about that in class.